Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Cynthia and Daniel, for giving me this opportunity. And thank you all for coming. Please stay on. There are some very interesting presentations after me. What I'm going to do is to present to you in the next 20 minutes the major impacts the climate change is likely to cause in South Asia and what sort of adaptation options are available. South Asia, as you know, when we talk about South Asia, we're talking about 40% of the world's poor. More than 1.4 billion people today and 22% of world populations, roughly one-fifth of this world is in South Asia. South Asia still has a very high growth rate of population, although we had made tremendous progress in the last four decades in terms of, you see, food consumption, in terms of GDP growth, and by and large, almost negligible food imports. Despite this progress, what we see today, that we still have largest population of hungry people, one-fourth of the world's hungry, 40% of the world malnourished children and women. We still lag behind as a region in meeting most of the Millennium Development Goals. Agriculture, despite progress in other sectors, still remains important for livelihood security for at least 50% of our population. That means roughly 10% of the world's population. And of late, there are several studies which show that the region is quite vulnerable to climatic risks. But climatic risks are nothing new to the region. We all understand that South Asia is very prone to climate risks all through. In the last 130 years, we had major droughts, and roughly 26 major droughts have taken place in South Asia. Floods, cyclones are common in several parts of the region. Frost is common in northern parts, and heat is again frequent episode. So this is what you see as manifestation of climate change, but some of these climatic variables already affect our agriculture. More recent studies suggest that climate change will bring additional stress. Several global studies indicate that South Asia could lose 10 to 50% crop yields. This is going to be fairly significant loss in case that happens. But these are general global studies. What is really needed is studies done at relatively local scales using models validated at national and regional scale. To that end, we have been doing large number of studies in that part of the world. And here you see field facilities where we have several face rings, for example, free carbon dioxide enrichment rings, several open top chambers, temperature gradient tunnels, a number of field experiments to develop coefficients for models and also to understand primary processes that go into models. And what this studies show, and this is the data collected over the last few years, variety of crops, wheat, chickpeas, green gram, pigeon peas, soybean, tomatoes, and potatoes, that when we raise CO2 to 550 ppm, the response in yield is roughly between 15 to 25%, depending upon the crop. It's more or less consistent with what is also the recent reports from different parts of the world. So our own studies also indicate more or less similar type of response in well-irrigated conditions. We also use a number of models in the region. Simulation models is just an example of mustard. So models are developed, calibrated, and tested against a lot of this type of data which I showed, and also against a lot of other field experiments. Now, based on that, what we do, we try to understand what are likely impacts on the region as such. And here I will give examples largely from India, but as you know, much of the South Asia is India. What we use here is an agroecological zone approach, 125 agroecological zones. We use our own in-house models called InfoCrop, consider regional variation in soils, sowing dates, irrigation coverage, use weather data, daily weather data, and several climate change scenarios. Here I will just show you results of PRESI, the regional climate change model, an A2 scenario. Just as an illustration, these are results for wheat. What you see here is that relatively near term, 2030 impacts. These are long-term impacts. And the red color means considerable loss in yield, and green color means relatively no change, a slight improvement in yield. And that's what you will see here. Much of the peninsular India, where temperatures are already quite high, is likely to significantly lose in production. And as time goes by, and if we don't do anything, you see fairly good amount of area where yields will be significantly impacted.
South of India is...
We don't have wheat there.
Because that doesn't grow wheat.
Yes. Yeah. That temperature is too high there. Yes. Okay, so now what I would just like to do is to give you a summary of the various studies that what do we understand today in terms of impacts of climate change. First, increase in CO2, as I showed earlier, is likely to increase yields of most crops by 10 to 20%. However, a temperature increase, and here it is sort of a mean temperature increase of 1 degree Celsius, could reduce yields of several crops, in some crops almost nothing, but in other crops up to 7%, and higher losses are expected at higher temperature. This is based on some of the simulation studies that we did across a number of crops. As a consequence of this CO2 and temperature and precipitation changes, what we see in short term, especially in context of mean changes, productivity of most crops will remain largely unaffected or only marginally decrease in short term, but will decrease significantly by 10 to 50% by 2100, and that depends on the type of scenarios, type of crops that we talk about. But what is very crucial, even in short term, increased frequency of droughts, floods, and heat events will increase production variability. I think this is an issue that we have to be really very much worried about. This is what causes lots of distress today, even today, and is likely to cause more problems even tomorrow. In addition to this, climate change may also provide some new opportunities for agriculture. We expect less losses in potato, mustard, and vegetables due to frost. Frost that's so common in northwestern parts is likely to get down to relatively lower scale, so much less losses due to that. Possibly some improvement in yields of chickpea, which is a very important leguminous crop for us, winter maize, sorghum, and millets, because the temperature becoming much more congenial for many of these crops. New areas may also become suitable, and vast variation in agroclimate. We have temperate climate, tropical climate, subtropical climate, arid, semi-arid, humid, subhumid. That provides us considerable opportunities for new land uses. But we still have to identify and exploit them in due course of time. Here is a very interesting example about apple, that what has been happening about apple, and that shows, in fact, that climate is, in fact, changing for quite some time. In Himachal Pradesh, the hilly areas, we have been growing apple for ages. But what has happened over the last 30, 40 years, temperatures have been going up, and apple, being very sensitive to the low temperature, is not able to meet its chilling requirement. And since the chilling requirement is not met, the crop yields, as you see here, over time are decreasing. Crop yields of apple are decreasing. So as a consequence, apple is shifting upwards. Apple cultivation is shifting upwards. But what is very interesting, the area vacated by apples, farmers have started growing vegetables, and in fact they are getting higher price than what they were getting by cultivating apples. And incidentally, they are also trying new varieties with less chilling requirement, and they are being introduced. But what is also very important, the areas, upper elevation areas where they were not growing any other crop, have started growing apples, and even they have started earning better money than what they were earning earlier. So in a way, this climate change has provided useful opportunities to both in lower elevation as well as in higher elevation. Let me move on to adaptation now. We are currently producing about 240 million tons. The demand in another 10-15 years is likely to cross 276 million tons. And that demand is increasing because of population and also because income of individuals is also increasing considerably. But if we have to produce this much, then we have to also keep in mind that besides climate change, there are many other constraints that we can be expect in future. We have big competition now for land, water, and capital from other sectors than agriculture. Technology stagnation is sort of becoming evident in many areas, and what we see increasing climatic risk. So how best to meet this demand, which is likely to be 276 or more by 2021? What are the options that we have? First thing is that situation is not all that bad. If we look at yield gaps here in terms of two major crops, wheat and rice, here this green bars are potential yields of wheat is about 6 tons and potential yield of rice is about 8 tons in the region. What we harvest today is just 3 tons of wheat and about 2.5 tons of rice. So there's an immense potential that's still available. Even if you look at attainable yields, they are also quite significantly large. The yield gaps here between potential yields, attainable yields, and measured yields today is still enormous. And that's sort of an insurance for us in time to come. And even if no new technology comes, even if we're able to bridge the skill gap, that could be considerable strategy for us to meet our food requirement. If you look at how exactly climate change is going to impact yield gaps, here this green bar is wheat. What you see here, climate change is likely to reduce yield gaps, largely because potential yields come down. But in case of rice, practically there is not much effect. So you see, even if there is slight decrease in wheat yields, wheat yield gap, still it is quite enormous in order to meet the requirements of food requirements of future. So this is one major area where we really need to focus how exactly to bridge yield gaps. And what we see here, some very simple options, very simple agronomic options that are already available today can help us in meeting this food requirement. Here is an example, for example, wheat here. In you see here 20% impact, what we can expect from climate change. You alter sowing dates, you alter variety, and you increase irrigation efficiency, and you see you can nullify this whole negative impact of about 20%. But since that's not enough for us, we need to produce more, not really just stabilize the yield. If we increase fertilizer efficiency and also provide some additional inputs, what we can see, these negative things could also can become positive in due course of time. So these are options that are already available, very well known, demonstrated in field. What we really have to do is to implement them. Both. This particular slide is more modeling based, but it has been validated in field. Now here, same thing, translated in spatial terms for wheat. Here, this is what I showed you earlier, how exactly the impacts are likely to be on wheat. But once we consider the adaptation option, you see lots of these yellow areas, which are decreased in yield, become green. That means they can produce much more than what they're producing today, even short term, provided we are able to address the key constraints that are there today. And we know what exactly are those areas where we need to work. We know, for example, that we need to focus on value-added weather forecasts. These are available. We need to promote them. We need to disseminate them. Index-based insurance, food, feed, seed, water banks, adapted varieties, diffusion of varieties, resource conservation technologies that several speakers have talked about earlier, soil and water conservation, intensification technologies, technologies for resources. All of these are already very well known. So what exactly is needed? We have to prioritize them. We cannot really disseminate all of them at the same time. We have to prioritize what is suitable and where it is suitable and at what cost this can be done. But point is that this is something that's doable, and we really need to focus a lot more on these than what we have been doing so far. I would like to move on to another point. That policy response has always been there. You know, it's not that policymakers don't respond. As often we say that we need to have this proper policy to address climate change or climate risk management. This is an example, again, from India. We are trying to trace history of droughts here. You see in 1877 to very recent droughts. You see here these red dots means each dot represents 1 million people died. So this, if you see here, 3 million people died. But after that, no one has ever died because of droughts. But number of people affected by droughts has been increasing simply because of population growth. So that's something remarkable. And why and what has happened? Now, if you look at policy interventions, there have been several policy interventions with every drought practically. Look here, for example, in 1877, we brought in Famine Code, then Green Revolution and food corporations, employment generation program, complementary crop plan, watershed approach, and improved weather forecast and the application. So policy has been moving from addressing scarcity relief, to drought management, to water management, and now much more to knowledge management. Policy has been responding. It's not that policy has not been responding. Only thing the policy has generally waited for some major drought event to occur, and then only it really happens. But despite all this policy, we still suffer considerable climatic risk. So if we really have to adapt, we have to look for options, not necessarily always in agriculture, but many of the options are outside agriculture. For example, here, what we see, why are we not able to respond significantly, why are we not able to minimize climatic risk, is because of widespread poverty still in the region. You see here in this particular graph, all these red shows population below $2, or less than $2 per day. Limited human capital, illiteracy rates are still very high, And above all, what is very crucial is poor governance. Overall, this is something internal, but that's something that we really need to address in order to have meaningful benefits of all the agriculture technology that are there. The final point is about about the greenhouse gases. In terms of greenhouse gases, the most recent data indicates agriculture per se contributes about 17.5% of the emissions come from agriculture. Remaining come from other sources like energy, industry, and waste. So this is still fairly significant. It has been coming down with time, but it is still a substantial source. Now, within agriculture, you see that 2/3 of the emissions come from enteric fermentation. That's the major source of greenhouse gas emissions in agriculture, followed by rice paddies, about 20%, and 13% from soil. Residue burning and manure management are relatively very minor sources of emission. And we have been able to do several studies by which we have been able to identify what are the hot spots. This is especially in the context of crops. So you see all those red areas are hot spots, that where the emissions take place, the larger emission take place here because of fertilizer, here because of flooded areas, and also because of intensive cultivation. But what is very interesting here is this slide. If you look at over time for the last 30 years, global warming potential from agriculture has been increasing. This blue line, that's what it shows, that over time, global warming potential, the emissions have been increasing from agriculture. But what is very important for us to see is in terms of emission intensity. With time, if you see this here, it's the global warming potential plotted per ton of field. This has really been decreasing. This is very significant change that we can note it. Note here that production efficiency has increased considerably. So at the same level of emission, we have been able to increase production significantly. And the same thing happens in terms of prices as well. Let me conclude here that I would just like to make three points. That first, the climate change is likely to reduce yields of most crops in long term in South Asia, for sure. But in short term, effects may be relatively smaller. But these are still preliminary results. We need much better field data, much better model, calibration, and validation. Increased climatic variability, which even today affects yields considerably, could, however, cause larger fluctuations in production, even in short term, and that could cause considerable problem for the region as such. Many options for adaptation already exist. It's not that adaptation has to be discovered. We know what sort of adaptations are available. They can be implemented. They are not complicated in terms of implementation. However, what it really requires is commitment from all types of stakeholders and innovation in packaging them, innovation in providing appropriate prices, implementing them, and upscaling these in different parts of the country. The final part, which I just illustrated, that there are problems related to poverty, governance, and institutions, and these have been limiting progress, including progress in agriculture even today. And unless we address them, these can continue to limit progress even in future. Thank you very much for your patience.